can turn to 1 Kings chapter 14. I want to continue our study from this book of 1 Kings. And we're still looking at a section of our study where we don't have corresponding material in the book of 2 Chronicles, as we've seen a lot of parallel between 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles up to when we got to chapter 13 particularly. But we're still looking at a part of, well, here in 1 Kings that doesn't have any corresponding material in 2 Chronicles, and that's why we've just been sticking with 1 Kings for a while. But now we're in chapter 14, and we want to go ahead and read verses 1 through 4 to begin this morning. 1 Kings 14, 1 through 4, and Brother Allen, could you read that for us, please?
That time Elijah, the son of Jeroboam, was sick, and Jeroboam said to his wife, "Lie so greatly and disguise thyself, that thou be not known to be the wife of Jeroboam. Yet he shall shine. Behold, there is an Elijah prophet who told me that I should be king over this people. But take with thee 10 loaves and fragments of the piece of honey, and carry them. He shall tempt thee, and he shall tell thee what shall be done."
Okay, so here Jeroboam has a son named Abijah, and his son Abijah is sick, and obviously he is very ill to the point where his parents are really wondering about whether he's going to recover or not. So this is a sickness that does suggest the distinct possibility of death, obvious from what he, what Abijah sends his wife to do, to go to God's prophet to find out what's going to happen with him. And then, of course, he does end up dying. So he's very sick, this child of Jeroboam. We mentioned, as we just touched into the very beginning of this last week, that this chapter gives us the opportunity to consider several important principles and lessons, as every part of God's Word does. But one of the things that we can think about and study about in this chapter is concerning things like this, where you have something. Something bad happens to a child. Here you have the death of a child. And this is something that can be quite challenging for anyone to deal with. And even those who have faith in God, that would be a great trial upon that faith, wouldn't it? But those that do not really have their faith in God, a situation like that can certainly harden someone against their Maker. And in fact, what is the favorite argument that those who don't believe in God will turn to or use as what they consider to be their evidence or proof that there is no God? Yes. That's also known as the Epicurean argument, because there's Epicurus, the Greek philosopher, I guess, popularized that argument in his time. I don't believe he was the first one to come up with that either. That's one that's been around for a long, long time, obviously. But at any rate, We still hear that a lot today. People that don't believe in God will say they don't believe in God because if there's the argument goes like this: if there's a God, then there wouldn't be evil and suffering in the world. And since there's evil and suffering in the world, then there really can't be a God, because then that would mean God isn't good. All right. Well, course, that argument is completely false, and on the one hand, it ignores the most important thing, and that is what? No, there's no philosophical argument that can undo the evidence that there is a God. Can it? I mean, what's the evidence that there is a God? The creation itself. And all that means, we touched upon this on Wednesday night in our study in Hebrews chapter 3, because in verse 4, what does he say about a house? And every house is built by some man, but he that has built all things is God. What is that? What is the... And that's the Lord's argument. That's his use of logic. But he's the one that is pointing out, therefore, that nothing comes from nothing, as we know. That when you have something, when you have a creation, there has to be a someone, a creator, who made all of that. An extension of that is also what is known in biology as the law of biogenesis, which means life comes from life. Life begets life. You cannot have the spontaneous generation of life from non-living things. I mean, if you think about it, some of the, and these are, in science, to refer to something as a law is, I mean, that's as strong as it gets. And it's not, there aren't a lot of things that in science are designated to be a law. There are a lot of things that, something has to be pretty strong, actually, if you look at the way, if you go according to the scientific method, for something to be established even as a theory, it has to have experimentation with observation behind it, and then to be able to repeat those experiments and observations, to be able to do that over and over again, that will establish a hypothesis to actually achieve the rank of theory. And that's one reason why it annoys me when I hear people refer to Darwin's theory of evolution. I mean, that's more like a philosophical theory, but as a scientific theory, it isn't. It doesn't meet the standard by long shot, because who has ever observed one kind, or well, even to use the scientific terms, even though there's a difference between a biological species and what we read in Scripture is defined as a kind. Who is the one that has defined the categories of living things in the matter that counts? Of course, it's God, the one who made it all. And when you read in Genesis chapter 1, he says that every seed bears after its kind and yields fruit according to its kind. Well, and that is a law. So a kind, as God defines that, will produce only after its kind. And so you, and many times we'll read in Scripture, do you plant a... does a fig tree bear olive berries? To use the quote from James 3. I mean, you don't plant one kind of tree and get the fruit of another kind, do you? And you don't do that with any living thing. One kind produces after its kind. And where has there ever been an observable exception to that? We have to be careful, because species are man's classifications. And man will classify as a different species things that will fall under what would be one kind in the biblical sense. I know in a way right now we're a little bit off track, but we're actually not. I'm going to try to, hopefully we can see how this applies to what this important lesson is, or one of the important lessons here in 1 Kings 14. Right now we're dealing with this issue of, well, yeah, there's evil in the world, and bad things happen, and even children can be the ones to suffer some very bad things, like here a child becoming sick and dying. So that's where we are. But then these other things tie into that, because this is so important to recognize and to deal with on this issue of understanding God's purpose for things, because there are lots of people that do reject God and will use situations like this when they occur to advance their unbelief and to say that there isn't a God. But the evidence is without parallel or without argument that there is a God. So, in getting back to it for a moment then, and as far as biology is concerned, a species, can you think of what would be one kind in the Bible that could have multiple species as men describe it? Well, how about dogs? And when we think of what the kind would be of a dog, when we think of a dog, what do we typically think of? We think of our pets, that kind of dog. When you think of the word dog, do you typically think of an African wild dog, or a wolf, a coyote, or one of those Australian dingoes? I mean, we think of those as distinct things, but wolf, coyote, African wild dog, Australian dingo, your pet, my pet, are those different species? Now, by biology, they are different species, but are they different kinds? Can they interbreed? Yes, they can. It's one kind. And so there can be differences within a kind. That's what we refer to as microevolution. You can have change within a kind. I mean, people, look at our room right now. We have a variety of different sizes, colors, and things like that. There's variety among us. But we're all what? We're all made in God's image. We're all people. We're mankind. We're not of a different kind. So we can see that there are differences within a kind. There can be changes within a kind, but one kind doesn't produce a different kind. Whether it's talking about animals or plants or any of that. So you do have to keep that in mind, because we don't want to get thrown off sometime. Well, how can you have this or how can you have that? And let man define the term. So man categorizes with its species, but we have to remember how God defines a kind. And there's not going to be one kind to produce another. All right, so, but this is getting at when Darwin, Charles Darwin, advanced his, what was is really nothing more than a philosophical theory that one, on the origin of species is the name of his big work. But where do species come from? Well, there's the word that's talking about man's categories, but he was teaching that, or believed and taught that all the variety that we have of living things all began with one common ancestor. So there you would have one original life form that all other life forms evolved from. Plants, animals, mankind, everything. And so there you have the evolution, the macro evolution of one, of all species deriving, evolving from one. Well, did we all evolve from the first one cell living organism? Well, Darwin said yes. Do we have any evidence, even one example in science of that ever happening, of one kind producing another kind? No. There's not one observable case of that ever. So how can it be called an actual scientific theory that there's macroevolution? You can't. There's never been an experiment that has resulted in it, and they have tried. They have tried so much under conditions. I remember hearing a lot about, because I majored in this, unfortunately, back in my college days in biology, and all I got was all of this evolution stuff. I thought I was going to be learning about stuff that would help me later on in medicine, but boy, was I wrong. And I would not have done what I did. I wouldn't have majored in that. I would have chosen something else. But anyway, I ended up majoring in evolution is what it really was. And it was sad to see because, you're told that by all the PhDs that have their degrees in that, the highest degrees in that field. What are you going to do? Just reject all that they're telling you about these things? Well, I did, but I was about the only one. It's just rare to find. Everybody's taught that and they believe it because that's what they were taught, and then they teach somebody else and that's just the way it is. But it's sad because it doesn't even fit with the other stuff that you're learning there about, well, what does it mean to have what is a scientific theory and all of that. So, but in science, evolution doesn't meet at any, even close to what is the scientific standard of a theory. Well, to go from a theory to an actual law, that is something that is so, so solidly proven by all evidence. It's so strong that it's given the designation of a law. There aren't a lot of those things in science, but we do have certain ones. Newton's law, Sir Isaac Newton. What was Newton's first law? Isn't that the one that is, matter is neither created nor destroyed. That the constancy of matter, that you don't, all matter that exists is, it may change form. We're not increasing the amount of matter now, nor decreasing in it. So, it's a very fancy way of saying nothing comes from nothing. Something to come from nothing, you would have to have, Newton was starting with what exists, the totality of what exists doesn't really change in terms of matter. But that's really a law, that you don't have something coming from nothing. That's a scientific law. Something comes from something, nothing comes from nothing. Yet, to not believe in God requires you to believe that something comes from nothing, because we have all of this something. But there's so much evidence that nothing comes from nothing that it's a law that you have to have something to produce something. You really wouldn't think that it would be that complicated to understand that principle, but yet, to reject God, you have to reject that. Another law, that law of biogenesis, which is the opposite of spontaneous generation of life. And for a long time, does anybody know what the scientist that was the one that's most famous for disproving, at least in the recent centuries, which is considered more modern science, disproved spontaneous generation? Was Louis Pasteur. And he did a bunch of experiments because they used to think that, well, rotten meat produced flies. That was what a lot of scientists were using that as their argument for how you have the spontaneous generation of life, because if you meat rots, all of a sudden you're going to see maggots and then you get flies. And so dead meat produced flies is what they were saying. A lot of people look, see that dead meat right there, there's your flies. So that came from that. So what did Pasteur do? Well, he put rotten meat in jars but had cheesecloth over it. So guess what didn't happen? You didn't have flies land on it and lay eggs that produced maggots that became flies. So rotten meat just rots. But if the jar's open and flies can get in there, they get on the meat, they lay their eggs, you get maggots, you get flies. So what did he prove? Well, you don't get the spontaneous generation of life. That life, you see, from those flies came from where? From flies. That was just a very a simple but pretty elegant experiment that proved, again, that law of biogenesis. What we know from the Bible, that every kind produces after its kind. And you don't have living things come from the non-living. But if you don't believe in God, what do you have to believe about all life? You have to believe that something came from nothing, and you have to believe that life came from nothing. You have to believe in the spontaneous generation of life. So you have to reject Newton's laws. You have to reject the law of biogenesis. You have to reject these scientific laws. And there's a lot more than I think Jan's gone into all the details of these things in his class with our younger folks, which is good for having that foundation to recognize that the evidence that we have, that there's a God, there's nothing that can undo that. The fact that we have something, whether design is evidence of a designer, something that exists is evidence of a creator. The one that built all things is God. So whoever's going to advance a theory of why they think there is no God based on some philosophy like Epicurus came up with, that so many are still espousing today, well, if there's evil in the world, there can't be a God. There is evil in the world, but the fact that there's evil in the world, what does that do with all the evidence we have of a creator from the creation? It doesn't undo that. So right there we know there's got to be something wrong with that theory, that philosophy that says if there's evil in the world, there can't be a God. We know there's a God because of all the things that exist. So then we're left with that question, that challenge to our faith. Well, then what does that mean that there is evil in the world? So we're not going to get... That still just presents the question there. We're going to have the answer. Obviously, the fact that there's evil in the world does not disprove that there's a God. And it doesn't condemn God as being evil. He's not. He is God and He is good. There is a purpose, and God has a good purpose for evil to be in the world. And He's got multiple purposes for that. We can't always see what that is in any given specific situation. And things happen in our own lives. There are going to be bad things that happen to each and every one of us. But we may not understand in any one of those situations exactly why it's God's will that that happened. But what we can learn from examples like what we have here with Abijah, this child of Jeroboam here in 1 Kings 14, we have one example here, a situation, a case where we can see what God's reason was for, in this case, for this child to die. That exact reason may not translate to a particular case that we may see in our own lives or our own time. It may or may not, but it does show that God has His reasons. He gives us the reason there. He doesn't tell us right now exactly why it's His will for certain whatever cases or things that a lot of things that we see. But from what He does tell us in His Word, we can trust, therefore, that God does have His reasons, and He tells us He does, and He tells us that He is good, and He tells us that He has a good purpose for all these things, even the evil that takes place in the world. So then we can trust in God and believe in Him and know that He's going to do His will, and it's going to be good in the end for us, no matter what. So we'll get into the specifics of that as we go forward here in 1 Kings chapter 14. The first thing that we get, Brother Young.
I was just going to comment that that basic principle that a lot of people were confused on with suffering, and they're not willing to accept that suffering is not wrong or evil. And unfortunately, even in the church, we see a lot of brethren that are sort of unwilling to acknowledge that God is behind things like this.
Or yeah.
You go to the book of Job, and certain ones will really start squirming, if you start pointing out, well, who was the one that was really behind the things that happened to Job? Because people are not understanding that suffering is not, that there's good purpose behind it.
Yep.
It's an important principle that we need to understand, and we need to try to encourage others to understand that there is a good reason for it.
Yep. And that's why we really want to get into the depths of that as we see this situation here with Jeroboam's son Abijah, because this is important, very instructive to us all in seeing how God works, because we'll see many examples that He gives us in His Word, we can apply those principles to even to situations that we don't know the specific reason now, but we know based on what God has said that there are reasons. But a big problem comes up when we accept, just like if we accept man's definition of a species and if it's contradicting God's definition of a kind, we have to let God define everything. If we accept, as we've already seen, just using that as an example, if we accept, well, no species can produce or there can't be evolution from one species to another, then if we ever accept that, then somebody can point out, well, look at this, and look at this, look at the wolf, look at the African wild dog, and then we might get all confused. Well, we shouldn't be. Well, it's just one kind, biblically speaking, but that's what we have to let God define that. And so there's no change from one kind to another. Well, do we let man be the definer of what's good? No. God is the only one that can define that. Who are we to say, well, there it can be no good reason for something bad to happen? Did God say that? That's what people think. We don't like it when something bad happens. But God has good reasons for those things, good purposes for those things, and He does make good out of it. So that we have to let God define that and teach that. So again, we'll have that opportunity here in this this chapter. So Abijah, Jeroboam's son, fell sick. Obviously very sick. I mean, really it would be fair to say deathly ill, because he does die from the illness. So what did Jeroboam do? Well, he speaks to his wife and tells his wife to disguise herself so that she would not be recognized to be Jeroboam's wife. And he sends her to Shiloh to see Ahijah the prophet. Now, who's Ahijah the prophet? Where have we seen or heard from him before? Back in... Yes, and that was back in chapter 11. He's the one that took that new garment and tore it into 12 pieces and gave 10 of them to Jeroboam. He was the one that God sent to Jeroboam to tell him that he was going to make him king over Israel, over the 10 tribes. He was also the one through whose mouth God made the promise to Jeroboam that his kingdom would be sure if he would obey God like David did. He would make his kingdom certain and steadfast, sure like David's, if he would be like David and obey God. Well, the prophecy that was in that event there in 1 Kings 11 was that the kingdom was going to be divided and Jeroboam was going to become the king of Israel, of 10 tribes. Did that come to pass? Yes. Well, just like we saw in the previous chapter, 1 Kings 13, there was another prophet that came. How many prophets of the Lord do we know that Jeroboam has had experience with now? Directly with two. Abijah back in chapter 11, and then that prophet in chapter 13 that came to him in Bethel at the altar prophesied against it, prophesied what was going to happen ultimately under Josiah by name, and then what was going to happen that then immediately happened with the altar being rent and the ashes pouring out. And we know from what happened there and then what happened to Jeroboam's hand, and Jeroboam then asked that prophet to pray to God to have his hand restored. It was. But Jeroboam recognized that prophet in 1 Kings 13 was a prophet of the Lord. But did he know that Abijah was a... It's easy to get confused now because Jeroboam's son is named Abijah, but the prophet is Ahijah. So if I happen to... I'm going to try not to say those backwards to get the B and the H and say the wrong one. But just as we see in verse 1, Abijah is the son of Jeroboam. And then in verse 2, Ahijah is the prophet. All right, so, and guess who, Rehoboam's son is going to be named, who's going to become king after him, that we get to start reading about in chapter 15. He's going to be named Abijah also. So we'll have we got Ahijah and we got a couple of Abijahs that we're going to be dealing with all here within two or three chapters. Ahijah is the prophet. Well, did Jeroboam knows that Ahijah is a prophet of the Lord, just like he knew in chapter 13 that prophet was truly from the Lord. The prophecy was fulfilled. Does Jeroboam have any doubt that Ahijah is a true prophet of God? No. If he had any doubt about that, why would he send his wife to him specifically to find out what was going to happen with the child? Well, he obviously knew God was speaking through Ahijah, because he told him what was going to happen with Jeroboam. So if he could foretell what was going to happen with Jeroboam, could he do so with his son? Yes. In this sense, does Jeroboam actually have more faith in God than, for example, Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, that fell down from the lattice in 2 Kings chapter 1, and when he was sick, he wanted to know whether he was going to survive? Well, when Jeroboam wants to know if his son's going to survive, he sends his wife to an actual prophet of the Lord to find out the answer. Now, we're going to see a problem. That doesn't mean he actually has a living faith in God. He at least knows that much or believes that much. Is that enough to save him? No. We're going to see the problem in this. If he really had faith, if he had a truly living faith, would he have sent his wife in disguise? What sense does that make? How could he, I know this is a bit of a preview, but how could this, just looking at the logic of it, Ahijah knew that Jeroboam was going to become king of Israel, and he did. And if he's also going to know whether his son, Abijah, is going to recover from his sickness or not, he's not going to know that this is actually Jeroboam's wife coming to him? Is he thinking? Is he thinking this through at all? I mean, just if he's going to use the logic and why he's sending her there, then why would he send her in disguise? Anyway, he does at least believe that Ahijah is a prophet of the Lord. And that's why he's sending his wife to him. When Ahaziah in 2 Kings 1 fell down, he wants to know if he's going to survive from his wounds. Who does he send his servants to? To Ekron, which was one of the cities of the Philistines over on the Mediterranean coast, to inquire of Beelzebub whether he was going to recover from his injuries. Well, then the Lord spoke to Elijah the prophet and said that Ahaziah, Ahab's son, was doing there. And told him he first went to his servants that were on the way and stopped them, but sent them back to the king with that message. Is there not a God in Israel that you send your servants to inquire of Beelzebub? I mean, for him to send his servants all the way over to the Philistines' land to find out what was going to happen to him means he doesn't believe that Jehovah is the God of Israel. There can't be a God in Israel if you have to send your servants to Philistia. So at least Jeroboam recognized, that there's a God in Israel, and that Ahijah was his prophet. Well, is that enough? That's not enough. Well, what did we see in chapter 13? Did he believe? Did he have any level of faith that prophet that came to him in that chapter was from God? Yes. He asked him to pray to God that his hand would be restored, and it was. But how did the chapter end? What was the last two verses of chapter 13 that we saw last week? What does it tell us was the result of all of that? I mean, he obviously believed on a certain level that there was a God and that this man was his prophet. But what about the words that he spoke? He wouldn't obey. So did his whatever degree of faith that he had, which he had some, did the devils have some? Yes. Even more than Jeroboam. Even certainly more than Ahaziah, Ahab's son. But the devils believe and tremble, James 2:19. But they tremble because they don't obey him. So they have a faith, but that faith doesn't obey. And faith without works is dead. Well, what works did Jeroboam's faith have in chapter 13? No works of obedience. It was works of disobedience. Well, here we see some faith on display, though. But again, it's not enough because that faith doesn't have works of obedience. But we can certainly see a problem in his faith, as we mentioned, the fact that he sends her in disguise to go to Shiloh, to Ahijah the prophet. But he mentions specifically there in verse 2, this Ahijah the prophet told me that I should be king over this people. Had that come to pass? It had certainly come to pass. He knew it. So, I mean, he knew that was... This is a true prophet of the Lord. And so he sent her and told her to take the 10 loaves and cracknels and crews of honey to go to him to find out what would become of the child. So what did Jeroboam's wife do? In verse 4, she did that and she went to Shiloh. That's where he was. This is when she got there. It tells about Ahijah at this point. What kind of physical condition is he in?
Couldn't see.
His eyes were set by reason of his age. Is there anybody else that we can think of in the Bible that it uses that language for? And it involved another situation with a disguise. Book of Genesis. Jacob, going to his father Isaac, he put fleece on his arms to make himself hairy, to be like his brother Esau, put his clothes on so he would smell, he would feel like Esau, he would smell like Esau. He didn't look like Esau, but that was not an issue there. For what reason? Isaac was very old and his eyes were dim by reason of age. What happens with age to sight when it says, I mean, it's recognized as a principle that people's eyes, their vision will dim with age. There could be a couple of medical causes for that. What's the most common cause for that? We're very blessed to have some folks in here have had it. Cataract removal. I mean, cataracts. I mean, that's a very common reason why people can lose vision. Of course, and there's glaucoma, macular degeneration. We won't get into all the medical stuff, but cataracts is very common. It's very unusual, in fact, if you live long enough where you wouldn't have cataracts. I had to have an eye exam a few months ago, and an ophthalmologist did a real thorough examination, and guess what she told me? She could see the very faint beginnings of a cataract. She said it should be many years before that becomes an issue, but she was forewarning me that if I live long enough, my day's coming. Well, guess what happens? Trey, don't think you'll escape if you live long enough. But anyway, we have these things that happen with age, but, vision going. That's one of them. Of course, yeah, we are blessed that there are things that can be done about a lot of things now. Very, very likely, very possible that could have been cataracts that he had. But whatever. I mean, whether it was that or some of the other causes for it. He was of advanced age. He couldn't see well at all. Really, from that standpoint, what's the point of her even being in a disguise? He couldn't see her anyway. But even if he had had 20/10 vision, and she walked in with in the best disguise that you could ever come up with, why would that not be an issue here? I mean, who was the one that knew that Jeroboam was going to become king of Israel? It was God. The one that was speaking through Ahijah. who would be the one that it would know whether this child was going to survive or not? The one who made him, God. Who would the God that could know and be the one to set up the kings over the nations, the ones who gives life and sustains it, that gives it, takes it, he's not going to know who's coming to the door of his prophet? How foolish is that? So, what happens when she arrives at his house? The next two verses, 5 and 6. Let's read that. See, Brother Glenn, can you read 1 Kings 14, verses 5 and 6?
And the Lord said unto Ahijah, behold, the wife of Jeroboam cometh to ask a thing of thee for her son, for he is sick. Thus and thus shalt thou say unto her, what shall be when she cometh in, that she shall feign herself to be another woman? And it was so, when Ahijah heard the sound of her feet, as she came in the door, that he said, come in, thou wife of Jeroboam. Why meanest thou thyself to be another? For I am sent to thee with heavy tidings.
Now, was that the greeting she was expecting? I mean, here you go, all this trouble, make this trip, get put on this disguise, and you walk in, and come in, and then you're called by name. Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Well, so much for that disguise. And why did it fail so epically? Because God knows everything. He sees everything. So he speaks to Ahijah and says, behold, the wife of Jeroboam comes to ask a thing of you for her son, for he is sick. And so he told Ahijah exactly what to say to her. And that she was going to feign herself to be another woman. Well, in fact, if God hadn't told her that, he wouldn't have even really known that she was in disguise. Because he couldn't see. So God tells her, A, who's coming and why. And B, that she's in a disguise. And then C, what he's supposed to tell her as far as what's going to happen to her son. So here she arrives at the door, and he says, come in, thou wife of Jeroboam. And then, why feignest thou thyself to be another? What would she answer to that? I mean, would the foolishness of all of this dawn on her? Who were the first ones to have a very foolish idea as far as God's eyesight? Yes. What did they do in Genesis 3 and verse 8? After they ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as they were commanded not to do, they had committed that sin. And what did they then do? They tried to hide from God. How successful was that? If they had considered that beyond a surface level, what would be the point of hiding? To hide would mean they would actually think that God couldn't find them, that he couldn't see them, wouldn't know where they are. What sense does that make? Who made them? I mean, he made Adam out of the dust of the ground. He made Eve from Adam's rib. God made all that garden that they were in, everything. And they think they can go find some place to go that he's not going to know where they are. What sense does that make? Well, they tried to hide. Did it work? Of course not. Did this disguise succeed? No, of course not. What's going to happen 8 chapters from now in 1 Kings? In 1 Kings 22. Well, we talked about the son of this man that didn't even have enough faith in God to send his servants to inquire of the Lord's prophet. Which there was certainly one there available, Elijah the Tishbite, but instead sent his servants over to Ekron to inquire of Beelzebub about whether he was going to survive. But who was the father of that man, Ahaziah? Ahab. What happened in 1 Kings chapter 22? I know it's a long chapter, 2 Chronicles chapter 18 parallels it. So Lord willing, we'll get to all of that verse by verse. But just in brief summary, Well, what did God promise would happen to Israel if they didn't obey him? Well, he promised a lot of curses, didn't he? Among those, concerning their enemies, what would happen? They would be defeated by their enemies if they didn't obey the Lord. And he gave them the full extent of the land that he promised them when they obeyed him. But when they disobeyed, what was going to happen to their territory? They would start to lose their territory to their enemies. Well, was Israel worthy of that under Ahab? Absolutely. And so what happened to the territory that Israel possessed on the east side of the Jordan River? Well, in that area toward the northeast, that was in the border region of which nation? Syria. And the Assyrians encroached upon the territory of Israel, and they took, this was in Gilead, they took the city of Ramoth in Gilead. Well, this was God's punishment for the disobedience. Well, Ahab wanted it back. Well, could he have gotten it back if he had fixed what caused him to lose it in the first place? And what was that? It's disobedience. So what would have been, what's the word that starts with an R that would have been the, we have a word that starts with an R and one that starts with an O, that if he had done those things, would have gone the long distance towards recovering Ramoth and Gilead. If he had repented and obeyed the Lord. But that's not what he wanted to do. So he's going to go with his army and fight to take it back. Who's he actually going to be fighting against? He's going there to actually fight against God, because it was God that took it from him for the Syrians. But going to fight Syria is not going to actually succeed, because it wasn't really Syria. When you get down to the bottom of it, it was God. So he's really going there to fight against God. Does he believe that? No. But he tries to enlist the help, the assistance of the one who has married his son to his daughter, the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat. And he calls him to go join him there, and Jehoshaphat does it. Well, now they're tied by, they're now in-laws. His son, Jehoshaphat's son, has married Ahab's daughter. Big mistake. That's the biggest mistake Jehoshaphat made in his life. Now, other than that, we're going to see in this chapter, Jehoshaphat did trust the Lord. He wasn't willing to go except that they inquired of a prophet of the Lord. Well, Ahab had his prophets come. And he was a worshiper of Baal at this point, which is why his son went to find out from Baalzebub, because he believed in Baal, not Jehovah. Well, where did he get that? From his parents. And so he doesn't believe in the God of Israel, the God of heaven, Jehovah. But Ahab had rejected him. So he calls his prophets, these false prophets of Baal, and they all go through put on their big show, and they all say, go up and it will be delivered into your hands. So you're going to succeed. You're going to take Ramoth and Gilead back. Did Jehoshaphat say, okay, great, I'm going to go with you now? No, he says, there's not a prophet of the Lord besides. Well, there is one, Micaiah. But he hates me, and he always prophesies evil again. Well, he prophesied, spoke the truth. Because Ahab, but did Micaiah hate Ahab? He hated what Ahab was doing. God did. He spoke the truth to him, because it was God's word, because God was angry with him for his wickedness. Well, Micaiah comes along and ultimately tells him, you're going to go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead, and it's going to fulfill Elijah's prophecy that the dogs were going to lick up his blood in the same place that the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the vineyard that was taken from him when Ahab allowed his wife Jezebel to set up those false witnesses against him so that they stoned him and that he was killed so they could take his vineyard that they coveted. And Elijah said after that, the dogs were going to lick up his blood in that place, that same place there. And Jezebel was going to be devoured, and there wasn't going to be anything left to bury. Well, that's going to be fulfilled a little bit after this. But this is the chapter where what was prophesied of Ahab comes to pass. So Micaiah tells him, you're going to go up and fall. This is all going to be fulfilled against you. So what did Ahab do there? Yeah, and to which Micaiah then replied, if you come back in peace at all, then God hasn't spoken to me. So he was prepared for a long imprisonment on a very poor diet, because he knew Ahab wasn't going to come back in good condition, alive at all. And he didn't. So then what did Ahab do? It was his next step. What did he get Jehoshaphat to do? Yeah, he got him to dress up like Ahab. I still question, why would Jehoshaphat, given that prophecy that he heard, why would Jehoshaphat agree to do that? So Ahab goes in not looking like himself. So basically, he's disguising himself and having Jehoshaphat look like Ahab. So that's going to spare him from that happening. But what is that then? That's another. Is there any difference in as far as the logic that Ahab is using in 1 Kings 22 from what Jeroboam's doing in 1 Kings 14? God was the one speaking through Micaiah. God was the one that had spoken through Elijah. God was the one that had taken Ramoth and Gilead using the Syrians. Is God not going to know which one is Ahab there? And who's Jehoshaphat? How they dress, what difference is that going to make? Did it make a difference? What ended up happening? Well, they were going to shoot Jehoshaphat, and he cried out. God spared him because of who he was. The fact that Jehoshaphat did serve the Lord. So God spared him in spite of the fact that he was foolish enough to go put on and dress up like Ahab, and the fact that he was even there with Ahab. He rebuked him for it afterwards, but God did spare him there. But what happened to Ahab? Did all that disguising and switching around save him? Nope. He caught the arrow right there in the harness of his armor, got right in there, hit the sweet spot, mortally wounded, bled out in his chariot. He died, and they brought the chariot back and washed out the blood right in the exact location where Naboth had died, and the dogs licked up his blood there, just like it was prophesied. It all happened because God made it happen, and he knew exactly who he was. So there's several cases of this kind of foolishness that we can read about, starting with Adam and Eve, and we can certainly see it with Jeroboam here in 1 Kings 14, as well as with Ahab when we get to chapter 22. But how many people say and do things that are on that same level of foolishness and don't think it through? Well, we need to then think about ourselves. I know we're out of time, but because we believe in God, we know all these things are true, but we need to look at ourselves. Are we living like that at every moment of every day? Are we doing foolish things where we're really, in a certain sense, acting like we don't really believe what we believe or what we understand and what we should know better? We'll have a little bit more on that, Lord willing, next week, but we'll then also hopefully see what happens with Jeroboam's son, Abijah, and why. But we'll continue there, Lord willing, next week.